Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night. Hope everybody is doing well, getting ready for their holiday season, whichever, you know, holiday you follow this time of year. There are so many. It's been an interesting few weeks for me. Things have been slammed. I am busy doing tons of pre-record stuff right now because of my typical January road work, stuff like that. So get ready for a ton of great guests coming your way, folks. We've got Jason Quitt in the lineup. We have Ryan Edwards. We have Bayer County Bigfoot coming up, talking about Bigfoot structures, things like that here in the state of Texas. Tonight, in the second part of the show, we are welcoming our good friend, Dr. John Hall. We were both just recently on Ground Zero with Clyde Lewis and talking about the new Havana Syndrome lawsuit that is going on, where the CIA is actively being brought to task in court, saying that they tampered with studies with Havana Syndrome people, baiting them in to purposefully divert where they got therapy and how they got therapy in order to garner data from them. So we'll be getting into that, how that is groundbreaking and amazing. Tonight, in the first part, we are welcoming back our good friend, Stephen Myers. He is the head of the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation. Everybody, you can stop off and check them out at thepump.org. They have some amazing videos with the hypothesis of using water and water locks to help build the pyramids of Egypt. We always love our conversations with Stephen. Welcome back to the show, Stephen Myers. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me back on the show. I appreciate it. I've been on your show several times now. I think I can be considered a reoccurring guest.
You are definitely. You are definitely. I love it. I love the fact that you come on a few times a year, and it's typically because I'll share an article or something like that in the Curious Realm group regarding pyramids, stuff like that. And it'll normally spur a conversation. I'll be like, hey, you know, it's been a few months. Hop back on the show. Because it's one of our favorite conversations on this show is the concept of science to begin with, Stephen. And the idea that science is living and breathing, and it's done through repetitive work, you know, and it's evidence-based. And Egyptology, as we know it, so much of it is, I guess, rote habit, much less than evidence based. You know, things. The one thing that we always point out whenever we have you on is that there is no writing in the tomb in the Great Pyramid of Egypt. So, like, it goes against what we would typically be taught as a high tomb in that kind of way.
Yeah, there's no writing other than some graffiti and that type of thing, but no formal writing inside the Great Pyramid, which is certainly different than many of the other pyramids in the Valley of the Nile. So, you know, to cut to the chase, I think the Great Pyramid was a machine and didn't need writing inside of it, just like an automotive engine doesn't have writing in the cylinders or anything like that. The Great Pyramid was functional and a machine. So, you know, there's no writing involved. And then you mentioned Egyptology. they oftentimes, instead of real science, they use peer review and that type of thing to validate the stories they come up with, instead of repeatable demonstrations. They've never made a casing stone like those at the Great Pyramid, a full-sized casing stone. They've never made a single surface of a Great Pyramid casing stone. Like they say it was done, but then they can still say how it was done and act like experts. You know, there are people who say cows jump over the moon, but they never demonstrate a cow jumping over the moon. So I put Egyptology often in the same light as a cow jump over the moonologist.
Yeah, yeah. And once again, just the idea that there is a heel dug in mentality and almost a rejection of new data. And we'll be getting, believe me, folks, we'll be getting to new data. We'll be getting to the post that I made that started this whole conversation. And then I've shared with you another post. But there have been numerous claims about SARS scans, things like that, on the Great Pyramid plain, and specifically at the Great Pyramid, showing a great cavity with all kinds of space, things like that, underneath the Great Pyramid. So we'll be getting into that here in a bit. But when it comes to constructing the Great Pyramid, like you said, they've never made a casing stone in the same kind of way. And the numerous attempts that have been made using ramps, levers, all kinds of things by National Geographic, other teams, they've never been able to scale replica a pyramid in a scale amount of time. It's never been able to really be done in that kind of way.
Oh, well, Egyptologists, they tell you every day how it was done. They'll breathe in real deep and then just talk like crazy about how it was done. You know, with the big ramp and all of this and blah, 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 and the big back muscles that the workers had and that type of thing. But Egyptology has never moved a 70-ton payload. What they have done is disingenuously moved like a 2-ton stone and say, well, that's how it was done. Well, I can pick up a car like a Tesla, okay, Model 3, let's say. I can pick one of them up and just lift them up, and I can give you a demonstration of lifting up a Hot Wheels car. There's an issue of scale, and Egyptology creates these disingenuous demonstrations that have the issue of scale that makes them invalid. When you go to colonial St. Petersburg, they show you how the colonial people made copper pots, how they did bookbinding, how they prepared leather, how they did woodworking, everything else.
Yeah.
And they are scientists because they demonstrate what they say how things were done. You know, they talk the talk and walk the walk. In stark contrast, Egyptology doesn't do that. They just declare edicts and are not scientific at all. So their ideas are unworkable anyway. They simply can't be done. But it's the only science out there, if you want to call it that, that doesn't engage in the scientific method.
And explain that for the audience real quick, because, I mean, we get into the scientific method regularly. In what way does the world of Egyptology in a traditional way not use the scientific method, Stephen?
Well, they don't do demonstrations. They don't do any demonstrations. They confirm their findings through unanimity of expert opinion, of peer review, which is the least valuable or the least valid way to confirm anything. You know, the big ramp that We live in a world where there's many inclined planes, dirt roads that go uphill or whatever. And we live in a civilization that has many 70-ton payloads, like an Abrams A1 tank weighs as much as the massive stones of the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, or a locomotive. All Egyptology has to do is take the wheels off a locomotive, drag it up a ramp, and people like me would shut our mouths. But Egyptology doesn't do that. They don't engage in the scientific method. They do form a hypothesis and then declare an edict that it's valid. Did you know that the location of the Great Pyramid has never been confirmed by peer review?
You mean the
everybody knows where it is.
Yeah.
You don't have to confirm it with peer review. It would be stupid to do that. But something much more complex, like making a 5 by 7 foot surface flat to 1/50th of an inch using hand tools, they say, that it was done using hand tools, and we all agree with that idea, so it must be valid. Egyptology is more of a hive mind or a almost a mystery religion. It's one of the last of the 18th century sciences that's going to go away. Phrenology went away, the study of the bumps on people's heads, you know, it's gone, and several other sciences that are now pseudosciences are going to go away. And Egyptology is headed for that same trajectory of rejection. It's not going to change. They're not going to say, oh, well, we were wrong, and here's some other ideas. They are almost a mystery religion. It's the only science that's been stagnant for hundreds of years. So it's strange. You pick up a mathematic book or a book on physics or a lot of things. And today compared to 100 years ago, and it's quite different. Well, but the Egyptology, it's all the same. It's just a stagnant mystery religion.
Well, and it's interesting that you bring that up. Okay, I mean, I love archaeology, things like that. But yes, there is a very hard reticence to change despite given evidence when it comes to archaeology. You know, when it comes to physics, things like that, there's things that change regularly. The example I give is my son's book on astronomy does not have Pluto as a planet. My high school astronomy book does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The college textbook from astronomy that my friends had did. So like that has changed within my lifetime. The definition of Pluto as a planet.
And there's no problem with that. That's called, they call that progress towards seeking truth, things like that. And I have a teacher, a daughter who's a teacher, and she often says, show your work.
Yeah.
You know, in mathematical problems or, in essays, you have to kind of demonstrate your position. But Egyptology doesn't do that. They don't show their work. They don't engage in creating valid scientific experimentation to lend credence to their hypothesis.
Yeah.
So they are very, very unscientific. And I don't know anyone past the eighth grade that's looked at this type of stuff and thinks that using hand tools to make Great Pyramid casing stones is even possible. Mm. Egyptology, you know, the casing stones are like a big block, about 16 tons. They've never moved a 16-ton payload to its side so they can carve the bottom of it.
Yeah.
A lot of the quarries are across the river. They've never put a 16-ton stone on, or a payload on or off a barge. They've never done anything. They just tell stories, and the next generation of Egyptologists tell the same stories.
Well, and you know what I love about your hypothesis for building the pyramids, Stephen, is really the simplicity of moving the stones via the water. Because if you're already bringing them down river to begin with, Why would you stop the barge and just start dragging it on a sled across the dirt? You know,
it's true. I know what you mean. Well, it's the idea of using water locks and barges certainly is elegant and sophisticated and gives honor and glory to the geniuses of those who built the Great Pyramid instead of just being knuckle draggers who haul these stones in a manner that can't be demonstrated. So it's strange. People say, well, you can't get water to the Great Pyramid. I've heard that for 20 years. But they've just recently discovered a branch of the Nile, you know, with they call it the Khufu branch that goes right by the Great Pyramid. And people that kept griping, well, it can't be a water pump because they can't get any water to it. Those people that at least know about that recent discovery have shut their mouths. So that's kind of interesting. Yeah, there's. But they, you know, people don't want to hear that. Most people want to hear, well, if it's a tomb, and the experts that are Egyptologists say it's a tomb. So. But, you know, truth takes a long time to get accepted. It's amazing. It is just kind of more of a condition of humans type of thing. I'm going to ask you a question.
Please.
Okay. Should women be able to vote?
I would say absolutely yes.
Okay. That was that truth was a hard-fought battle to get accepted, you know, in our civilization. You know, it took a couple of generations and a massive amount of fighting to get that truth accepted. So it's that's what we're up against, and it takes a long time.
It does.
To come to fruition, like these recent scans, these SAR scans, I'm going to end up the rest of my life saying why those scans are wrong and why the chambers that those scans discovered will never be walked in, will never be, you know, they don't exist. So,
well, let's before we get into the scans, because we will get into the scans tonight, folks, believe me. Let's start talking about the pyramid itself as a device, as a pump. And not only that, but the idea of constructing the pyramid using water.
Yes.
So, go ahead.
Yeah, they use water. There's a profound link between water and the Great Pyramid water pump. And they used water at the building site to assemble the Great Pyramid. They brought stones on barges from the Nile all the way up a series of water locks to the Great Pyramid building site. And then the barge went right. The casing stones were cemented in place, watertight. And it was built level by level. So they, the first level of casing stones impounded a pond, and the barges could go all the way up the water locks into that pond. And then they would move the stone, the interior stone, off of the barge and into the pond. And the Great Pyramid was built. You know, the process was faster than what it takes to explain it. Let me put it that way. So it was built by geniuses in a genius manner and that type of thing. So the lower in the bedrock, the lower passages and chambers acted like a water pump that they used to supply water up at the building site. And, you know, it's kind of like when we build a skyscraper, we bring in one of them tall, spindly cranes to lift, you know, objects up, elements of the skyscraper.
Yeah.
But in ancient times, they used water to lift heavy payloads up. But I wrote a book about how the Great Pyramid was built using water locks and barges, if I can figure this out here. Anyway, Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid. And it describes the construction process. Very interesting. And yeah, I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
And we have an explanation for the direct physical evidence. People often say, well, what evidence do you have?
And yes, I
say,
oh, please. That's easy. What evidence do you have?
Yeah, I have the same evidence everybody else has.
That's what I said happened.
Yeah, everybody's got the same evidence. There's nobody that's got evidence that somebody else doesn't have. There are certainly different interpretations of the evidence.
Absolutely.
People that are tomb robbers, also known as Egyptologists, say, oh, there's a big building there, and we want to steal the treasure out of it, but it's already gone. So because there's no evidence, it must have been a tomb. So yeah. That's their interpretation of the same direct physical evidence that I and everyone else has.
Oh, man. But when it comes to, is there any kind of erosion? How long would it take, because there is, of course, the estimate of how long it took to build the pyramids, but would it have taken a scale amount of time less by building it with water or?
Well, Egyptologists have a story of like 20 years or whatever, but based on their demonstrations, which they haven't done any, the period that it would actually take to build the Great Pyramid would be infinity if you went by the way Egyptologists says it was done. So that's one interpretation. They haven't even made a single casing stone in 200 years, so it would take a long time. If you did it the way Egyptologists say it was done, which can't be done anyway. But I would say 7 years. You can move those stones up those water locks fast. That's why they built the Erie Canal when it was built before, because it was fast to move cargo, fast and cheap. And that's one reason why New York City and New York became a ultra wealthy part of the United States was the Erie Canal, all that commerce and everything.
Yeah.
From the inland, they could bring grain and coal and everything else. But I think it was quite fast to build the Great Pyramid using water locks and barges. In 2 years, the Erie Canal, which was 4.5 feet deep when built, moved the equivalent weight of the Great Pyramid.
Wow.
And it also moved it higher than the Great Pyramid. One end of the Erie Canal is over 500 feet higher than the other. Mm. So that gives you an example.
Yeah.
It was 4.5 feet deep originally. The barges could handle a payload of 70 tons, which is the weight of the largest stones of the Great Pyramid. So there's certainly a lot of corollaries between that. And the book goes into all kinds of evidence, physical evidence that indicates there's a profound link between water and the Great Pyramid. So I hope people read that. We did create two documentaries.
Yeah, the video series.
Videos, if you will. And now they were on DVD, but we wanted to make them available to everybody worldwide. A lot of people can't afford to buy every DVD out there they see of interest. So they're free to watch on our YouTube channel. So you can watch our documentaries. We have one about how the Great Pyramid was built and also the fascinating process of how the Great Pyramid operated as a water pump, you know, with all passages, chambers, sliding stones, and other enigmatic features if it was a tomb. And how do long open passages and sliding stones protect a pharaoh's treasure?
And baffles inside of passages, things like that. And this is one of the articles that I just popped up on screen from BBC, that heard an episode all of a year ago. And did the Egyptians use a lift to build the pyramid? And yes, there are numerous scientists now who are following the water lift hypothesis and the idea that, yeah, they basically used existing water pressure from the reservoir of water below to push these things up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But certainly much more than strong backs and ropes and that type of thing. So, yeah, it's interesting. I've been at this for quite a few years with the books and everything, and you get more and more independent confirmation in this direction of research, as opposed to, Egyptologists declaring edicts that have been declared for 100 years, and that's the story they're sticking with. So it's rewarding for a humble researcher to see other independent sources discuss water and pyramids and that type of thing.
Well, exactly how did the pyramid operate as a pump, and how did it help? Because you once again have the Great Pyramid Prosperity Machine book.
That's my second book. The research is divided pretty evenly between how it was built and why it was built. Well, we think that they used a number of aspects of physics that allowed water to go through the Great Pyramid water pump. Some have compared it to a modified hydraulic ram water pump. You know, people say, well, where's the big shafts and the big diesel engine and all of that? But no, it's not like that. It's different. So they used water came in the descending passage, the upper end, and went down into the subterranean chamber. We think that the end of the subterranean chamber that is considered unfinished is actually like a water break, and water came in one end, and that water break caused a large whirlpool, a vortex, like Victor Schrauberger talks about, and they use the force of implosion to pump water up from the subterranean chamber, and then ultimately in the Grand Gallery, they used electrolysis to separate the hydrogen and oxygen from the water. Those two gases, when mixed, are highly volatile.
Yep.
And they ignited those gases at the proper time, which resulted in a vacuum, not an explosion, but an implosion, if you will. That vacuum caused water to move up in the Grand Gallery. And then they released that vacuum, and that was like a 300-ton water piston that moved back down, and it moved water through some valves into the Queen's Chamber, then ultimately into the King's Chamber, and then out the King's Chamber vents. So it's a pretty sophisticated and elaborate water pump that's certainly different than the type of water pumps we use in modern times. So it's for a lot of people, it's hard to recognize how it actually worked, but it that's what we think. The book, my second book, gratuitous plug here, it is about a prosperity machine, and it talks about how the Great Pyramid pumped water and why they wanted a big water pump. And we think that the Great Pyramid, I have several presuppositions. One is the builders of the Great Pyramid were geniuses. You know, I'm not trying to prove that. It's a presupposition.
Sure.
I think that they were geniuses. You know, I act on that as if it was true. And the other presupposition is that the Great Pyramid had a return on investment bigger than the cost of building it. And if it didn't, then it wouldn't be worth doing. So if somebody tells you a purpose for the Great Pyramid that has a small return on investment, it's probably not the reason why the geniuses built the Great Pyramid. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I mean, a lot of people, you know, oh, well, we can't talk about return on investment or anything helping anybody. But, yeah, they had a return on investment. I can't think of anything, you know, that doesn't. The Notre Dame Cathedral, you know, it was built there in Paris, and it's wonderful. But people were paying tithe there for, what, 700 years?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was worth building, let me put it that way, if I could be so bold. And everything, you know, a hydroelectric dam, the sewer system, it all is expensive to build, you know, but it all has a huge return on investment. But if something didn't have a huge return on investment, it wouldn't be worth doing. So I think the Great Pyramid was a prosperity machine. It transformed the desert into a garden. It transformed poverty into prosperity. It transformed hunger into being full, and that type of thing. So it was infrastructure that helped the original builders in a tangible way. It wasn't an ineffective tomb that didn't work to protect the pharaoh's carcass.
Yeah.
So that would be a really low return on investment and an ineffective purpose for the Great Pyramid.
Well, and especially when you're talking about, you know, once again, yes, there is an aquifer like directly beneath the Great Pyramid. So the idea of using the structure of the Great Pyramid, there it is, as a pump itself, as a siphon by which to get water out of the ground, is a really interesting concept, Stephen.
It is interesting. It is very interesting, you know, and it gives a functional purpose of the Great Pyramid. I think the largest water pump in the world is in the Valley of the Nile. It's the Mubarak pumping station. You know, people say, well, you don't need a water pump if you got all that water right there in the river. Well, that's not true. Water in the river is worthless for irrigation. That's why every farmer in the world has some sort of a pump to pump water from the river up onto your land. And that's true in Egypt. When I led my tour a few years ago in Egypt, we had like a 4-day cruise down the Nile. You know, a lot of people do that.
Yeah.
But hundreds of these intake pipes coming out of the Nile that went to water pumps. Why would they do that? Why would they spend all that money to do that when they have the water right there? Well, it's true everywhere in the world. They got to pump the water out of the river to you know, to irrigate their lands. Then people say, well, they had that yearly inundation every year. Yeah, they've had it. But the High Aswan Dam was built to stop that. And then they built the High Aswan Dam. It generates electricity. And now in that hot desert, they can irrigate all year round. So so that's why they use the electricity from the High Aswan Dam to pump water. So the High Aswan Dam is part of a water pumping system. The Great Pyramid is part of a water pumping system. So it's all interesting if you allow yourself to think about all of this stuff. And people are the same. You know, that's the one constant about ancient times and modern times. You can understand their motivations and their reasoning. You know, I know what the ancient people in the Valley of the Nile wanted. They wanted their kids to eat every day.
Yeah.
You know, just the same as they did in the Depression. They wanted their kids to eat every day. So our civilization did the WTA, and we built dams and all that stuff here in the Pacific Northwest. A lot of dams and other infrastructure to provide prosperity. Everyone watching this show is ate an apple that has was irrigated by pumped water, more than likely from the Grand Coulee Dam in Washington State, that irrigates over, what, 1.5 million acres, you know, in perpetuity. Yeah. Yeah. So big return on investment. That's for sure.
Well, it's kind of like the story of how all the water got to Los Angeles and everything else. Like natural means.
I grew up in L.A., so they built all those canals, and it's prosperity, you know.
Yeah,
they can build homes. They have everything with all stealing the water from everywhere else.
Yeah,
with all those canals. I grew up in Los Angeles. Very, very interesting history.
Yeah, and the fact is,
Chinatown is about the water wars.
Exactly. That's what I was just about to say. It's a great example of it, and of the fact that yes, Hollywood and everything else that we know right now would not exist the way that it would without that.
No. So they did all that infrastructure, Mulholland with all of the, you know, the dams, canals and everything. And it made Southern California what it is today. So, yeah. And that's true for a lot of places, a lot of, it's not just water, you know, it's the power grid and the sewer system and the highway system and all of that. Yeah, it costs money to build freeways, but there's a huge return on investment.
That's right.
All the packages from Amazon come on them roads. And, we're all happy campers right now around Christmas. So infrastructure provides prosperity. And we think the Great Pyramid was infrastructure. Yeah. To provide prosperity.
Well, precisely, because there were really two main motivations behind civilizations at that time, and that was religious motivation and motivation for better survival. You know,
yes.
that was basically it. So once again, if it's a religious site, great. I would once again love to see the carvings, the writing, anything like that that would indicate that it was built and intended to be such, you know. There aren't any as compared to most other tombs, things like that.
Most other tombs, writing all over the tombs and other pyramids, you know, all, you know, the ceiling and everywhere. But people, when you make that statement, people say, oh, there's writing. You look at the Book of the Dead, and then that proves that the Great Pyramid had some religious or symbolic or whatever purpose. But the Book of the Dead is not evidence specific to the Great Pyramid. There's no Book of the Dead in the Great Pyramid, no writing. So people are pretty sloppy with their research methods and make up some interpretations that aren't really valid. And people are catching on and not believing that stuff anymore.
Well, and that kind of brings us directly to the article that we were talking about at the beginning of the show, which is, of course, the recent things coming out from Dr. Biondi, things like that, about SARS scans and scans being done. And granted, you know, not necessarily using the interferometry of the satellites in a ground penetrating radar kind of way. Because like we've mentioned before, they would get very low result in that kind of way. What they are doing is using these satellites to measure the distance between things in a seismic way and showing kind of in a means of echolocation a reflection image of what is under the Great Pyramid. And that's what they're claiming.
Yeah. Sounds good to claim something, that's for sure. But they also say that they're based on these SAR scans don't penetrate very far at all, like a yard, you know, 6 feet maybe at best. But they're claiming that they are sort of analyzing in a proprietary way
yeah.
that we don't, we're not allowed to know about, using micro vibrations and kind of cooking the books a little bit and looking at the the tea leaves and that type of thing. But it's fine to have a scan and say, hey, this is a scan, but it's just an indicator. It's an interpretation of evidence. It's not evidence in and of itself. And it's just the results of the scan is usually fuzzy pictures. You know, they make them nice and colorful, and then they, you know, divine meaning from these scans, and it's you know, and then you get crystal clear big columns or tubes with the springs, you know, the pogo sticks looking yeah. things
yeah
and all of that. And you know, I think it's what a saying you don't hear much anymore, leading with the chin, you know. It's not let me put it this way. Putting, if somebody can walk inside those big things that are well below the water table and walk around there and shake hands with aliens and take pictures of it, that's not AI, then I will say I stand corrected. But the people that say yes, that's what's down there, when it's determined that that stuff doesn't exist, then their reputation as a researcher is destroyed. If those structures exist under the Giza Plateau, I say that they don't. If they do exist, my reputation is destroyed. But that holds sure. true for those. It's going to be a litmus test in the future that, oh, this guy, he thought that those scans were really valid, so he's not that good of a researcher to be duped. It's, into believing that.
You know stuff. What? I parry and thrust back on that, Stephen, because that would be like saying that, like, Edward R. Murrow was a bad reporter because he didn't believe that there were multiple shooters.
Okay.
You know? He would have been a hardline no on that because of the way things fell, because of the data that he had available at the time. Okay.
Right.
And this is the argument that I've made for Avi Loeb. It's a comet. That's what I say. There could be things that come out from it tomorrow and come down and say, hey, and you know what? I'll go on air and I'll be like, I was wrong. More than a comet. Will that ruin my reputation? I don't think so. I would hope not.
Yeah, but you're saying it could be a comet. The proponents of these SAR scans say this is what we've discovered.
Yeah.
There's a big difference.
Well,
also, the people who say the Piltdown skull is valid. I did my doctoral thesis on it, and it's valid. And I think it's valid for my entire career. I will not acknowledge the file marks on the Piltdown skull, and then I died. Those people don't have a very good legacy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the Piltdown skull was validated the same way most of Egyptology validates things, by peer review.
Well,
we all think it's true, and we have a hive mind, so the Piltdown skull must be true. And then they say, people who are bootlickers to science, if you will, say, well, science advanced, so we know it's not true. Well, was it true for 40 years, or were they wrong? Well, no, I won't really talk about that. You know what I'm trying to say? So if, you know, the pursuit of truth is a tough battle, as tough as it was to acknowledge that women should be able to vote. So, you know, if you're going to be a researcher, you have to be a warrior as well.
Well, and you know, to be a scientist, and I say it on the show all the time, the phrase I use is, we need more Magellans. We need more people who are willing to say, give me five boats and five crews. I'm going to sail to the tiny thin line and we'll see if I come back, dang it. Because that's what science is, and you have to be willing to put yourself out there. So I laud these guys for what they're doing. Do I think that the data is pointing to what they're claiming? I don't think so. Much like I don't think the data from 3i Atlas points to it being an alien craft. It is, it ain't interested in us. It's not beaming us a signal. It's not responding to any signals being beamed or anything like that. So they have no interest in us if that's the case.
Yes. You know? Magellan did say, give me some boats and we'll go figure it out.
Yeah.
The Spanish king said, sure, I'll give you these boats as a investment, expecting a return
Absolutely.
Of a bunch of gold.
Exactly.
So that's how that works. But Egyptology is unique in that it is the most wealthiest science on Earth, with all of its priceless artifacts that have been stolen and all of the ticket buyers that pay money to go see it. So Egyptology is very lucrative and has all of this financial resources and well-heeled donors, so they don't have to ask anybody to fund a demonstration. They can make a casing stone and prove what they're saying, but they won't do it. They can move a 70-ton payload in the manner they say it was done. They won't do it.
Yeah.
You know, the people who say cows jump over the moon won't demonstrate that either. So it's a unique situation, this Egyptology being the last remnant of these bizarre 19th century pseudosciences that hasn't fully been, invalidated. So it's, and it's not just about the pyramids. I think that their interpretation of hieroglyphs is up to question. The sequence of pyramid construction is up to question. When the Sphinx was created is certainly up to question. And, there's a lot of chinks in the armor of Egyptology, and they are, circling the wagons and that type of thing. So, so we live in a strange world, a revolutionary world of changing ideas.
Well, yeah. Yeah. And once again, the thing I always say is whether you're a scientist, a researcher, what have you, I am a skeptic. And I wear my S like Superman, like ready to go. I'm not there to debunk things or anything like that. What skeptic means is that I have an informed opinion based on the research that I have done. And I am looking for the research and the data that will change my mind. Like I'm open to the idea of changing my mind. I would love to be proven wrong. So feel free to bring me the data that proves me wrong.
Yeah, being proven wrong is to advance in your understanding,
exactly.
If you will.
Exactly.
And on the flip side of that, I'll put it this way. I'll believe in anything if you give me the data, which is sort of the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
I'll believe that bread mold will make sick people well. Bring me the data.
Yeah.
You know, that's penicillin.
Yeah.
The story of penicillin is fascinating. It was discovered and kind of developed. And for 20 years, the experts, we don't need that. We never needed it, or it's too expensive, or it doesn't work. You know, or we've never done it that way. And finally, after like 20 years of Alexander Fleming fighting to get penicillin widely used, that it finally was. And it was the military that helped spread the use of it, because they knew they were going to need that type of thing. So it's just interesting. You think, build a better mousetrap or find a different idea and people will run to it. It's just the opposite. But, being a researcher, I study like physical stuff, and buildings and physics and that type of stuff. But it's been a sure interesting character study of the human condition on this type of thing. So it's been an exciting adventure in my life to study the Great Pyramid, write some books, and go to Egypt, do wonderful talk shows like yours.
Well, I appreciate that. And we always love having you on because, once again, as we say at the end of the show, it's the open heart, the open mind that makes the conversation, you know, and you've got to be willing to have the conversation. If you aren't willing to have the conversation, if you aren't willing to court other ideas and philosophies, or even just red team, blue team things. Like there was once a fine art in the world of debate, Stephen, where even a debate club, things like that, like you were given a position to defend and you got that position by drawing it out of a hat. Mm-hmm. Like you didn't necessarily believe in the stance that you were made to defend. But what it did was gave you a unique opportunity and a unique insight into what that stance believes and why they believe it. You don't have to believe it yourself.
That's true. But to be able to defend a position or to understand why some people think a certain position is defendable is important. They don't have that anymore. That's all gone by the wayside. And I try to, on that same vein, I try to read almost half of the books I read are books that I don't agree with, you know, and they're rather interesting. And there's two things can happen. I might learn something and say, oh, well, that's something I didn't know. I'll agree with it. Yeah. Or I might learn why I can defend myself in a debate as to why I don't agree with it. And I don't know a single, I know I've talked to a lot of people, or they'll on Facebook, well, tell me what's in your book so I can find out if I want to read it or not. And it's like, wow, I would never ask an author what's in their book, you know, ever.
You should purchase it totally by the cover. You should always judge a book totally by the cover.
It's, you know, when people say, oh my God, tell me what's in it so I'll know if I want to read it or not. I always tell, oh, it's just full of awesome wonderfulness.
Yeah.
You know, because they're not going to read it anyway if they have that position. So, you know, Graham Hancock, you know, he's a tremendous author and blah, blah, blah. But can you imagine going up to him? Hey, stand there and tell me what's in your book. And then if I agree with it, I'll read it.
Yeah.
Those people, you know, a lot of people like that, when they disagree with the direction of my research, basically they come up with some scenario in their head, and then they debunk the scenario they came up with. And then think that has something to do with me, you know, that's my research. It's strange. So then we go through, you know, waste a lot of time straightening out their misconceptions, but never really talk about my research. And then they wonder why they're so frustrated.
Well, and you know, once again, your research has been going on for years. I remember first hearing you on like Coast to Coast AM, things like that. And being fascinated by the concept and digging into it and buying your book, reading it, the ideas behind it, many of them are very common sense when you start thinking about it. Once again, the idea of there already being a branch of the Nile River that ran right there, why not just dam it up, flood the area, and direct them right over instead of having to move them again, you know, things like that.
Right. Now Egyptology, they're not constrained by common sense or demonstrations. Mm. So they have no interest at all in this direction of research. So, but I appreciate your kind words, and not all hosts you know, are so generous.
Well, and you know, We have you. I appreciate your kind words as well. And I always love our conversation, Stephen, because to me, it is the fact of you've got to be able to take in new data. You've got to be able to look at new data. And once again, I will gladly take it. I open the conversation to the folks with the SAR scans. I would love them to come on the show and show me the data. I would love to be able to have somebody look at the math and check the math, that kind of stuff. I think it's fascinating. If it's a fun rabbit hole, and it's interesting to look at. I don't look at it in any kind of way as being the hard reality as of right now. I think it's an interesting vein in which to research, and if you can get echoic readings in that kind of way, a sonographic response in that kind of way through seismic readings, cool. Let's work on that some more. Let's get it honed and get things checked in a different way and in a repeatable way.
Right. I'm in favor of any kind of scan you want. They've been doing scans of the Great Pyramid since the 1970s. Yeah. What I liked about the Pyramid Project scan that used the Muon technology,
yep,
when they had a scan and they said, our results indicate that there's some type of a void above the opening, and there's some type of a void that's indicated by our scan near the Grand Gallery, the big void, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what they said. But, and then the one, the smaller void above the entrance of the Great Pyramid has been confirmed. The scan didn't confirm it, but they have put a little camera up there. I'm sure you've seen it. Looks like an attic, if you will. So, but the people that are doing this other scan, this SAR scan, they say, oh, well, yeah, we discovered it. It's there.
Yeah.
You know, here's all the details about it and that type of thing. So I think they're, leading with their chin. They are, got a lot of frosting, but not enough cake is another way to do it.
All right.
A lot of smoke and not much fire.
What?
And, hey, I'm interested in the Great Pyramid. If they find a bunch of stuff underneath it, hey, that's, man, I'll have another 30 years of study to do. But, we will see. We will see how it, progresses or doesn't progress. Just like the internal spiral ramp.
Yeah.
It's not progressing.
Yeah.
You know, there's a few guys that say, oh, that idea makes sense. But, you know, a recent, probably better scan didn't find it. So, you know, maybe it doesn't exist. So scans of the Great Pyramid, I think, can be wrong.
Yeah.
So
Interpreted data can be wrong. Interpreted data can be wrong as well.
So. All of it, yeah. So we'll see. The Great Pyramid and the Giza Plateau gives up its secrets very slowly, and
absolutely.
And it's an exciting time. You know, it's an ancient structure. More books have been written about it than any other structure on Earth, and it's fascinating. I'm having a great time studying it and all the other implications. One other thing, our organization is a humanitarian organization. We think the ancient technologies of the Great Pyramid can help us in our modern but very troubled world. We think it's a non-polluting alternative to oil, natural gas, nuclear, and even hydroelectric dams have environmental impacts. So if we have another alternative way to pump water cheaply, I think it would be beneficial to our civilization.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Thank you so much, as always, for your time, Stephen. It's always great chatting, always great following you on social media. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to purchase your books, other than the Curious Realm store, all that kind of good stuff, where they can go to follow you and where they can go to get involved with the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation.
Well, all my books are available on Amazon.com. My two documentaries are available free on YouTube. My books, if you have Amazon Prime, you can download them as ebooks for free. So that's one thing. I also have a third book that is my most recent. It's Pharaoh's Pump Analyzed. It's in ebook format only because it has so many illustrations. And it's just, it's more actually quite technical for a lot of people, but about the Great Pyramid and all of that. So if someone's interested in my third book,
great,
and that type of thing, maybe I'll write a book about the logical fallacies of the Orion correlation theory. Who knows? But we're doing a lot of stuff here. Our foundation's website is thepump.org. You can use that as a portal to go to my Facebook page or YouTube channel, find out what we're about, our activities.
Great.
And how you can become involved. You know, you can pray for us if you want. You can put a link on your website to our website. You can, when you're chatting at the office, you know, by the water cooler, say, hey, you know, maybe the Great Pyramid helped people in a tangible way. So, yeah. You know, we're not asking too much for, you know, anybody. We are a nonprofit, so all donations are tax deductible.
Absolutely. Stephen, thank you so much, as always, for the conversation, for the time, and for the very candid demeanor. It's always great chatting with you. So,
well, you put me at ease, and it helps.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much. You take care. Have a great holiday season, my friend, all right? We'll talk
to you
soon.
Same to you.
All right. While you are online checking out everything from Stephen Myers and the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation at thepump.org, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That's where you can go to our videos page and find all of the videos of our guests, all of their YouTube channels. Stephen's YouTube channel from the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation is embedded there. When we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend and author of Guinea Pigs, Technologies of Control, Dr. John Hall. We will be talking about the recent Havana Syndrome lawsuit, which has come to bear, suing the CIA for suckering people into coming in, getting checked so that they can basically get their scans as to what the brain damage was. So we will be getting into that and so much more, and the advocacy for targeted individuals and sufferers of Havana syndrome right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much for staying tuned through that. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by True Hemp Science today. Check out their products. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use a spigeric process where every part of the hemp plant is used and reused, combusted and reused. And I mean every part, seeds, stems, roots, buds, leaves, all of it is used and reused until an amazing spigeric product results, complete with awesome terpene profiles and great benefits. Stop on by, check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. And get two edibles on your way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Dr. John Hall. He is the author of A New Breed, Satellite Terrorism in America. He is also the author of Guinea Pigs, Technologies of Control, which is a book that I recommend to so many people that have become interested in the targeted individual topic over the last many years. Welcome back, John. How are you, my friend?
Great. On the show.
Let me unmute you. There you go. Sorry about that.
Oh, sorry. So I said, great to be back on the show.
Always great to have you, man. And, you know, we were both just on Clyde Lewis this last week talking about Havana Syndrome updates, things like that. You did a great job breaking so many things down. And like we have said numerous times on this program, even with Dr. Duncan, whenever he was on, rest his soul, the idea of disclosure of this topic, the idea of bringing this to the public eye, and the end of targeting as we know it has to be a legal means. And the fact that there is now, let me bring up the Wisconsin Law Journal here. The Wisconsin Law Journal has reported the fact that there is now officially a case, for witness tampering against the federal government in the Havana Syndrome cases. And while researching this, I actually ran across this from Steptoe.com. Steptoe is a group of people that for years have been helping folks sue the federal government, all kinds of things. But there was Mark Lindsay, who has reached an actual, like, discrimination and retaliation settlement with the government. So progress is being made, finally, Dr. Hall.
Yeah, kind of in a backhanded way. It's kind of one of those things where, as when we were on Clyde Lewis's Ground Zero the other day, you know, you and I both, yeah, you know, kind of went through the light chronography of it. And it kind of went from, you know, my story came out and my book came out, and, you know, I was bombarded with people that were going through the same thing, that were being targeted by directed energy weapons. Yep. And so I wrote about it and kind of used the letters after my name to kind of have at least an air of credibility to talk about it. And luckily had connections within intelligence agencies to get, you know, good information to write about. But, you know, that still kind of wound up labeling me as the Pied Piper of the crazy. You know, the only person crazier than the targeted individuals is the doctor that actually believed them and wrote about it. And it vindicates me a little bit and the victims of this to see that at least once some governmental people were targeted by it, with Havana Syndrome and the agent in the embassies and in China and in Vietnam and then D.C., and including children. Right now, there's, I think, over 1,000 government employees that are voicing anomalous health incidents, and 15 of those are children that are family members, you know, of these diplomats. So while I'm not happy that it's happening to anyone, I don't wish this on anybody, but at least now that it's in the government sector, it's kind of forced the government to acknowledge it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, not only with the lawsuit that's being currently saying that the CIA mishandled the investigation, but even with the fact that, you know, the DHA, the Defense Health Agency, has a Form 244, which is, you know, a kind of descriptive way to care providers on how to handle a patient that comes in complaining of AHI, and a DHA 245 form, which actually is a registry to keep track of the people that are actually complaining of it and that are seeking help, you know, through the government or through TRICARE, you know, which is actually seeing people, family members as well, that voice concerns of AHI.
Yeah, because once again, it wasn't just diplomats. It wasn't just foreign service members. It was their families as well. Wives, husbands, children. Like you said, a good dozen children at least have suffered this traumatic brain injury that happens from this.
And it was kind of odd that, I mean, we've been making noise in the private sector, the civilian sector, for about 20 years now. You know, I mean, it's, yep. You know, like I've said, I've had a New York Times article written about me and a haunted people syndrome, you know, named after me based on, you know, what I described in my books. So it's not like they don't know who I am.
The haunted people syndrome is my favorite one.
The John Hall effect, they called it. So you would think that when the Havana syndrome, you know, came out, when the diplomats and the CIA agent people started, you know, complaining about it, that the people doing the research and actually checking them out maybe would have actually turned to me, but it wasn't them that turned to me. It was the victims that turned to me because they weren't being treated right by the agencies that were looking at it. And as it turns out, I think the reason for that, and I'm going to be real honest, is CIA knew exactly what they were being targeted with because it was probably them doing it. So they really did try to point the investigations in a way that wasn't factual. You know, if you remember, they initially said it was competing signals of other surveillance equipment in the embassy. Yeah. And then they said it was crickets chirping. And then they said it was permethrin, you know, which and then they had Psychology Today come out with an article and say this was a classic case of mass hysteria.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, so mass hallucination.
Yeah. So they went, you know, every way they could rather than admit it. Now, some of that is to admit that China or Russia has this technology is to admit that we have it too.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want to come out and say that we now have technology that, you know, that your privacy has been so degraded down to the point where we can hear your thoughts in real time. You know, and that's what they don't want to admit to, because these diplomats weren't just hearing the having tinnitus, you know, and hearing buzzing or hearing, you know, ringing in their ears. They were hearing voices of the people that were targeting them as well.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And you know, like I got into the other night, the idea of, because, hey, I've got an AI trained in my voice, man. I pay $5 a month. I can't imagine what the government has access to.
Yeah.
It may not even take theirs 20 minutes of training to sound like you. You know,
well, and it's amazing that you brought that up the other night, because that's exactly how they've targeted people all along. I mean, when they have a targeted individual that they're harassing, you know, they will use the voice of that person's mother, the voice of that person's father, their wife.
Yeah.
You know, later down the line, after myself and Duncan became popular as advocates against it, then we started having victims that would call us and say, well, you know, I've heard Dr. Hall enough that it's Dr. Hall harassing me, you know, through electronic harassment, or it's Dr. Duncan harassing me. Or like you brought up, the lady that was hearing Obama's voice, you know, harassing her. Well, any of us that have enough sound bites out there to sample from, you know, our voices can be created.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't take that much and it doesn't take that long. My model, and I literally took it. It was an interview with Jason Quitt that I trained it with. But I took 15 seconds here, 30 seconds here, a minute there of me speaking, so that it got conversational. It got passionate when I got passionate, things like that. You know, it was different than reading a script. Because at that point it was a conversational style, and it was, man, just in 15, 20 minutes of data that I gave it, it came out pretty dang convincing, dude. And I'll play it real quick just so the audience can hear how accurate this is. Everything you know, everything you feel, everything you are might not be what it seems. That the solidity of the ground beneath your feet, the vastness of the sky above, and even the passage of time might be an illusion? Imagine for a moment, just a moment, that you're living inside a hologram. not a hologram like the kind you see on a credit card or in a side.
There's people like my brother who, after about 2-3 minutes of listening to this, was like, wow, man, that's pretty good, but I can tell it's not you. There are a lot of people that would fool right off the bat, John Hall.
Been the problem with this technology all along, and AI is just worsening it because they could do that already 20 years ago. I mean, every single targeted person that I dealt with thought it was their family members that were part of it. And the reason they thought that is because when they're laying in bed at night and they're being harassed, it's their wife harassing them, through V2K, or it's their husband, or it's their mom, or it's their father. Because the one thing that they do want that targeted individual to do is strike out against a neighbor or a family member, because that's a one-way ticket to the loony bin.
Oh, anything to cause a well check, stuff like that.
Oh yeah. Once you accuse your elderly mom and dad of being the ones that are somehow in cahoots with the CIA to electronically target you, I mean, when they go to the police with that, you're going in for an evaluation.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. And oddly and scarily enough, the laws in most states when it comes to actively committing somebody or having somebody committed, are pretty open, like it is not a difficult process, sadly and horribly. I guess in some cases, good that it's not a difficult process, because there are definitely people out there that need real help in the world, John. However, when you're talking about somebody, who once again has been taken via well check, stuff like that, it's fascinating to see how fast that process can go through.
Well, I don't know if you've considered having him on, but I imagine he would be probably receptive to it. But I'm not going to mention the name, but right now you and I both are working with somebody that it appears that his targeting was done according to the initial targeting of a girl that I wrote about in my first book.
Oh, wow.
If I don't know how much of his story you got, but his story sounds like a new breed, and that all took place in 2000, actually a little bit before 2000. It was written about in 2000, we're 26 years later, and that technology has got nothing but better. And now that AI is involved with it, it's pretty much foolproof. If you want to make somebody think that, their husband or their wife is part of their targeting, all you have to do is sample. And I've told victims all along that even when this first started, part of the reason for the stalking part of it is once they stalk you for long enough, they know who your family members are. They know where you regularly turn to. They know who you're going to turn to when they finally start letting you hear it, because they work with your mind for months before you ever hear a voice. And they have followed you for months before you ever hear a voice.
Yeah.
Once they start the harassment part of it, they already know who you're going to turn to for help. And those people are already either being controlled or, they're going to intentionally make you think they're part of it. So you turn on them and alienate them from being able to help you.
Yeah. Yeah. It exactly. And, I'm pulling this up right now because this is Datamine Discovery. And this is about exploring the world of remote targeted cell phone collections. What that means is real time distance collection of data from a cell phone. They don't have to plug your phone in to get the data, to download the data, to get the meta tags you've been looking at, to get the search history you've been doing, to get the social media or anything like that. All that stuff can be gathered remotely, John. So the idea of being able to craft literally the way somebody thinks, it was 2012. But 2010, I'll give it 2010, when I first moved to Austin, one of the first gigs that I worked with a guy that I used to do shows with was a white hat hacking conference at UT. And the former head of FBI cybersecurity was there speaking. And to all these white hat hackers, this was 2009. Blackberries were just becoming a thing, you know, all that kind of stuff. We didn't have the phones that we have now. But he said with just the data from your cell phone, that and this way he was like 5 years ago. So 2005, 2004, with just the data from your cell phone, the FBI could reliably predict with an 85% accuracy rate where you would be 5 minutes from that point. So that's just metadata from your phone location showing that, like, hey, you happen to stop at McDonald's for a cup of coffee every day on your way to work, that you go to your mom's three times a week, and it's typically on Wednesday, Thursday, and Sunday, you know, and during these times, stuff like that. So when you start thinking about the data that they're gathering on you now, when you start thinking about biometric data that's being taken by, like, literally, folks, when you opt in to social media, and I'm getting ready to do this to show it in real time, Instagram actively takes pictures of your face with the infrared camera on your phone while you're scrolling to see your eyes, to see your pupillary dilation, to get biometric data from you as far as, like, do you like what you're seeing? Is what you're seeing angering you or things like that, to feed you the next thing algorithmically? So this kind of data is out there. Your biometric data, the things that move you emotionally are out there. So it's easy to hijack.
And we've been doing this long enough where you remember probably when we first met, when you were on a, you know, part of a large syndicated show at the time. I won't even bring up the name, but you know, we were taking people, part of the experimenting we were doing with to make sure it wasn't being done with chips or anything like that, is we were taking people out in the middle of ranches with no cell service or no electricity, and on boats out into the Gulf of Mexico, you know, into anechoic chambers, and see if we used a research anechoic chamber, if that would block some of it. Well, if you put somebody in something that absolutely stops every type of wave from coming in, yeah, they subjectively got better. But if you just took them out into a ranch with no electricity and no cell service, now that wasn't 5G at the time. It might have been early LTE or 3G. And you took him out to a boat into the middle of the Gulf, far out away from any electrical lines, power lines, wind towers, or anything like that. They were still being targeted. You know, they were still being attacked. And all of these people had the stalking first. And I had thought all along, you know, we did a bunch of scanning. We tried to check people for chips. Yeah, we did find some implants in some people. We found some Verichips in some people.
Sure.
You know, I'm an expert witness right now with a guy against the Navy that we did find some microcircuitry, you know, not nano, but micro in him that was injected into him through a dentist. But all in all, we didn't find a whole lot, you know, doing the scanning. And as it turns out, that's probably part of the reason for the initial stalking phase is to get biometric data. And, you know, and now, especially, I can't name the company. I've talked to you about it off camera and on the phone, but there's one particular company that it looks like it is the company that actually is responsible for most of this technology. I'm still doing some research onto that before I actually take the risk of coming out with
pull
a name.
That thread. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I told you, I mean, I had a guy come up to me on Halloween night at a Halloween party. There was a bunch of people there. He knew who I was. And he told me, I used to work for this company. Yeah, we knew who you were. And one of the things that we were fearful about you is you're the only one that seems to be talking about how it actually is done, and the truth. And I'm sure he picked up his phone and he said, I'm going to show you, we can zoom in on somebody, anybody we want to, that's in the system, you know, and can actually read the lettering on a pin that's in their pocket. And we can attack them with directed energy. We can put voices in their head or we can vaporize them if we want to. So, you know, and this company deals only with government contracts. And as a matter of fact, he said that part of the reason they were pissed off at the CIA right now is the CIA owes them $12 billion in fees for leasing the technology. So, I mean, while it might be the government doing it to you, they're doing it to you with civilian invented technology.
Yeah, and I've got up right now from Popular Mechanics. This is literally from February this last year, new LiDAR technology that can recognize your face from a kilometer away. So they don't have to be near you. They do not have to be in the house across the street. They don't have to be, they could be kilometers away. Like, good God, we've been able to read Titleist on a golf ball from space since like 1978.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and if you, and if the particular company I'm talking about, if you remember, you know, they don't allude to all of the secrets on anything public, but even some of the public stuff they had out is, you know, they have facial recognition that they can use and track you with from 6 miles away. So.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, China has biometric data that can recognize people by their gait, all kinds of stuff. And even the idea, let's start digging into this right now, because one of the big things that I try and tell, targeted individuals, TIs. Play a clip from one here in just a minute that I've been authorized to use on the show. Somebody who called in to me and gave me part of their story and how things happen. So we'll listen from him, and then let's get into some of the technology and how this works, and specifically how the rabbit holes of this feed into their technology in a biofeedback kind of way. Because I think that's something that we really need to point out to a lot of people. Here's the clip from that TI.
I have been targeted my whole life. I could go through everything, but I'll just say some of the highlights. I was mind controlled as a kid. I was degraded a lot. As a teenager, they would sabotage me sexually. The big attack started when I was 19, just starting college and stuff. They would, make me have the fear of God and make me incredibly paranoid and act really strange around my friends and family. I went to try to get help. We thought I had schizophrenia. So I was trying to get help through medically, and, eventually I went homeless, from more sabotage. I did not graduate college because they would attack me during work and school, and they did another set of heavy attacks from the year 2019 to present. They started hacking me a lot. They would make me feel pain and torture from the signal that they have on me. They would they've been sleep depriving me lately. They got me fired from jobs all my life and made me get into car accidents all my life. So I'm ruined financially. Let's see. They started V2K around 2020 and I'm still hearing them to this day. There's a lot of sabotage, a lot of.
And this is just, I mean, this is very much blueprint material here, John. This is.
Yeah.
What we hear from targeted individuals all the time. And it's hard when these things are happening to you, to have clarity of mind, because once again, there's sleep deprivation involved. There's all kinds of things involved, that leave your mind and your brain off kilter. And the more off kilter you are, it's one of those, the better their technology works. You're basically giving you're producing the stress hormone, cortisol in your body. And that cortisol response really does kick your brain into a fight or flight mode, which only makes their technology easier to use on you.
Oh yeah, it definitely, it's, everybody goes, well, you just don't let yourself go into a victim mindset. Well, it creates a victim mindset.
Yeah.
All on its own. And not only cortisol, but, when you're hit with microwave energy or any type of directed energy, it decreases a hormone called ornithine decarboxylase, which is one of the, it's a neurotransmitter type hormone that actually, you know, helps cells repair itself. So, the whole time you're being attacked, it is causing cellular damage as well, and it's increasing dopamine levels. And that's one of the things that eventually over time, as the targeting continues, your body will downregulate the amount of dopamine that's being produced and how your receptors handle that dopamine. But at the first instances of targeting, when your brain is not used to having that kind of energy coming through it, your dopamine levels go sky high. And when dopamine levels go real high, for a long time, that was a hypothesis of schizophrenia in its entirety, is that schizophrenia was excess dopamine. It was called the dopaminergic theory. And it's somewhat true, because when dopamine levels are very high acutely, when they spike, people have a very schizophrenic look. And that was designed that way intentionally, because they want you to have that look, because the whole point is that it was supposed to mimic schizophrenia or psychosis in the first place. But it's kind of funny, because when I talk to a lot of targeted individuals, when they're first being targeted, you can sit with them and they don't trust you talking to them. Everybody that walks by is part of it. Anybody that maybe gives them a glance is glancing at them because they're part of it. And it's all that high dopamine level. And once things kind of regress and they accustomize themselves to the dopamine levels and they downregulate, well, then you could actually talk to them, have a little better conversation, and get through to them that it's not your parents doing it. It's not your wife doing it. You know, it's not your neighbor. It may not even be anybody in your city. You know, it's, you know, somebody pegged you somehow. Were you a whistleblower? You know, were you arrested at some time? Were there drug charges? Every city, every group has a group that's doing this to people, and every group has a different reason or a bias to who they target. And in the end, it looks like one big mixed bag of victims that they can get data from. So,
and that's just it. And that's what I brought up the other night on Clyde on Ground Zero, was the idea that, it seems much more like it is actors and contractors thereof of alphabet agencies that are testing this almost random sample status. And sometimes almost as though it's being swathed in an area to see who responds.
Yeah. And that's one of the theories we had early on, is that, you know, the way I describe it to people is I'll tell them, you know, if I put a voice inside your head that sounds like you, if I have followed you and I have tracked you long enough where I know what you sound like, and I can, and especially now, use AI to simulate your voice, if I put your voice in your head, well, that becomes a thought in a lot of people, and you'll act on those thoughts.
Yeah.
And that's one of the ways they control people. There's a difference between control and harassment. That's harassment is when I put my voice in your head and I'm saying, you know, you think you're pretty cool drinking coffee with them shades on while you're doing your show, don't you? Curious realm.
Hey.
You know, and it's that kind of thing. I mean, it's schizophrenics hear God and angels and, you know, streetcars or garbled voices that they can't really make out.
Yeah.
When you hear true schizophrenics describe what they hear, you know, what targeted individuals hear are conversations from someone that they can think their answers back to, and those people respond correctly.
Yeah, there's a call and response to it.
Yeah. And the first time that I've ever heard of somebody describing it that way was when this was under experimental testing at the Utah State Prison, and they had four prisoners that they put in a cell, and they all said that the energy levels in the cell were such that it was repressive, that it was difficult just to get yourself off of the bunk and stand or walk or do anything, and that they were hearing conversations in their head that they all realized that they didn't have to speak back to, that the people were responding in their head correctly to the answers that they gave back in their head. So, I mean, it was a very succinct description of synthetic telepathy in 1988.
Yeah.
So that's how long this has been around, and it's only getting more perfected each day.
Well, and again, the idea of the mindset, of where people come to and how that technology hijacks them. And once again, even talking with the TI that we've been talking with lately, it was great to see the fight that he has in him, because you have to have that.
Yeah.
But you also, and what I was telling him last time I spoke with him, was you have to have a very well-developed sense of self, which sadly not a lot of people have, Doctor. You have to have a very well-grounded understanding of who you are, what you stand for, what you believe in your heart of hearts, things like that, because when it comes to your own voice telling you things, you have to be able to discriminate that, and you have to be able to discern the fact that that voice that you're hearing that sounds like you, ain't what you think, and it ain't what you believe.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the sad part is this has been restricted to a, you know, couple hundred thousand people that identify as targeted individuals, but it's not, that's not where we're at now with the technology. I mean, the technology is now at a place where it's going to be everybody. And, you know, and Jeremy, when we were on Ground Zero the other night, brought it up. You know, he said, you know, in your first book, you mentioned some terms that were eventually going to be common nomenclature in the English language that at the time nobody knew about. And that was remote neural monitoring, electronic harassment, and organized stalking. And now, if you mention any of those terms online, people know exactly what you're talking about. And at the time when my first book came out and I coined those terms, I mean, everybody was like, man, the first thing that a lot of these targeted people got questioned was, why would somebody spend this kind of money to target you? Well, when you're using this electronic technology, it doesn't cost anything. Your tax dollars have already paid for it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And once again, these things have been done through studies at universities. This technology has been developed. And, you know, going into some of this, especially with the communities, things like that, Doctor, yes, I will always say, because once again, you are testifying in a case where there was technology implanted in somebody. There are people that have been implanted with things along the line, most definitely. Does it require some kind of nanotechnology to make this happen? Absolutely not. You don't need to like drink a glass of something and it got into your system. You don't need to be injected with anything. You do not have to have a tooth replaced with something in it. You don't, because that's just it. It's the fact of they would have to physically get their hands on you in some kind of way, shape, or form to implant you or inject you with this technology.
Which is why they developed it where you don't have to. Because yeah. that if you don't have to assault somebody or drug somebody and count on them having no memory of it. Now, like you said, yeah, have we found that? Sure. We have. I mean, there's some really famous cases that I actually worked with, you know, where we found Verichips that were people were drugged and implanted with Verichips or implanted with micro technology. But, you know, kind of my fear was when it turns out that the technology is, if you're able to do this without an implant, well, then there was certain factions that said, well, then it's got to be nano. If we can't find it with a CT or an X-ray or a 5T MRI, then it's got to be something smaller. Well, that doesn't explain the people that this was happening to in 88, 89, 90, you know, prior to nano. And if it was nano, I think it would be more widespread.
Yeah.
Now, not to say that nano isn't an issue. It is.
Sure.
You know, because there's a lot of stuff out there in environment now. I mean, even more and more people are finally realizing that, yeah, that's not steam that's coming out of those contrails. You know, they are spraying, you know, barium and aluminum and all kinds of stuff that they claim is to lower the temperature of the environment. My personal thought is that it's probably to make the environment more electronically viable for some of this technology, you know, but I'm not saying that it isn't. And if you think maybe you've been implanted, it's probably worthwhile to be scanned and look for it. But I will tell you this, that the DHA 244 for anomalous health incidents, that is where the military doctors get their instructions on exactly how to work up a patient with this. It doesn't involve any type of scanning for implants, and even an MRI is down the road. So.
Well, and that's just it. You know, once again, you don't have to have physical means for this to be done. And that's kind of, I think, what makes some of it more frightening than anything, John, is that it's not like you're going to be snatched up off the street in a white van and come back with no memory. You could just be walking down the street and it happens. You could be sitting in your own room. You could be laying in your own bed. You could be anywhere doing anything. And this invasion upon your life occurs. And once it starts occurring, and they found that, and the way I was explaining it to the TI that we've been talking to, I was like, basically, it's the fact of they poke, they prod, they send out signals and see how your brain responds. And as soon as they fire, it's no different than feeling the combination lock click, you know, feeling the tumbler fall into place. Something like that. Once they found the frequency with which your brain uniquely responds, it's like tuning in a radio.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I told him too. And then once you have that link, and that's why I'm glad you have worked with me on some of the binaural beat programs and things that we work with, because what I found is if you can break the link, because a lot of it is they trap you into this, you know, call and respond type of technique, where as long as they're beaming voices at you and you're responding back to that conversation, that maintains the link. And I know it's real tempting. Do you want to listen to everything? Because you can, you know, just for people who don't really understand the way this works, when these people are being targeted and people are talking to them in their heads or in vibrations around them, you can hear the background around where those people are broadcasting from, essentially. Mm. I mean, if they're near a train track, you can hear a train rolling down the track behind them. If they're near a highway, you can hear cars passing over or a jet flying over. You can hear the surroundings from the people that are targeting you, and they can hear the surroundings from the targeted individual that they're monitoring. I mean, it is a two-way communication link, you know, cut and dried. I mean, it's really as simple as that. Along with that, though, are weapon systems that can be used on you once you're identified and you can be tracked within a geospatial quadrant. So the way you get away from being victimized by the weaponry is by breaking that communication link, which is what they use to actually track you and find you on a grid. So, I mean, everything we do is to actually break that that link, you know, so you can actually escape from some of the more horrendous things, because the voices in your that they're targeting you with and the 24-hour harassment with talking isn't the worst of it by any means.
No. Once again, as that experiencer just said in his, it becomes the point of personal and sexual humiliation. All kinds of things. It becomes the fact of things start happening at work. Things start happening with your family. And when you get to a point of not only distrusting yourself, this is what I think most people don't understand, John, is when you get to a point that A, you can't trust yourself. You can't trust your own thought form as to whether or not it's your own and unique. But then you can't trust your family who you've gone to, who doesn't believe you, or who thinks you have some kind of other problem going on. And now you're targeted from two directions.
Yeah.
You know,
and then you end up in front of a psychiatrist. And if you're, you know, if you found me, then you're going to the psychiatrist and you're throwing my books down and saying, well, here's a doctor that wrote about it. Well, that ain't going to do you any good either, because the only person that's crazier than you is the doctor that believes you.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, it's, and that's, you know, the unfortunate truth. Now it's getting a little bit better. And I think it's going to get a lot better if the CIA ends up having to come out publicly and at least somehow admit this is true, because backhandedly, the admission is already there. You know, if there's even, they're saying that they mishandled the investigation and that there's a cover up, you know, Mark Zayed, who's the whistleblower attorney in DC, you know, is even kind of, you know, he usually rides kind of a fence between the agencies and the victims, but even he's admitting that there's probably a cover up, you know, they're trying to pass an act, the Mind Act right now, that protects your neural data, which includes your emotions and your thoughts. So everything is kind of circling the wagon saying, yeah, we got this technology. We can hear your thoughts now. Yeah. You know, we can hear your emotions. We can alter those through remote neural monitoring, but they still have fallen short of saying, we've got technology that's so invasive that, you know, you've got no more privacy. We can hear your thoughts if we want to in real time. Now, and I don't think if that will ever come, because I think they're afraid it'll change society, kind of like UFO disclosure, you know. Yeah. to admit there is an entity, whether it's dimensional or interstellar or whatever, that we're not the only ones. You know, that's gonna mess with some fabric as far as society goes and religion goes and a lot of things. And I think that what they're afraid of is if everybody finally knew and they admitted, you know, if we target you, we can hear your thoughts. Well, everybody's gonna have an outcry about that. I mean, nobody wants to think, okay, I'm going to church and I'm praying, which would probably be the most personal form of communication, but it can be heard by the government. Nobody's going to want that. But the technology's not going to go away. So, I mean, the lawsuits, the Mind Act, all of that, you know, finally trying to get the legal system to catch up with the technology is about the best we can hope for. And so that way there's some oversight, you know, but right now, like I said, it's a private company that has invented this technology and perfected it, and it's being leased out to the government.
Well, and so a lot of this comes down to the fact of, I've got it up on screen right now, we don't have a national legal definition of digital identity, John Hall. It doesn't exist. Yeah. So many people I know are just, they hate the cookies. I hate having to opt in to see a website, things like that. The reason that exists is because your unique fingerprint on the internet of how you think. So that is literally the beginnings of the Mind Act, is the fact that, like, other countries like the UK and things like that already have a full-on description, a legal definition of what a digital identity is. And it is how you think on the internet, how you cruise the internet, how you drive the internet, how you use the internet is part of your digital identity of who you are and how you think. So no, the government should not get access to that without warrant, you know.
Well, and the other thing too is, you know, the government, there's no laws against the government experimenting on the public, not hard and fast. And another thing for your, just for in case your listeners are curious, you know, we're talking about the Mind Act and the lawsuit against the CIA for not studying this. Well, this goes all the way back to 20 years ago with the Space Preservation Act, the original copy of the Space Preservation Act. And you have to bring it up. I don't remember exactly the year, but it had language in it that specifically said that they were looking to try to keep satellites from being able to attack humans, you know, neurologic well-being, you know, and to hear thoughts and pick up brainwaves. So this isn't far-fetched. I mean, if you're trying to create an act against it or a law against it, then
2001.
You know, yeah, then it's already been in existence. Now, when the final preparation of the Space Preservation Act came out and finally went to Congress, a lot of that language was taken out of it. But the congressman that originally wrote it specifically was concerned about satellites being able to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah. And would there be that concern if said senator wasn't read into something or had seen documentation to said thing? You know, that's just it. That's just it. And you know, granted, people can say all kinds of stuff about what people propose bills for, doctor. However, this was something that was specifically against the weaponization of space. Yeah. And part of that was for psychotronic mind control devices to try and keep that out. So obviously the concept is there. Somebody spoke to somebody in the halls of Congress about the concept, you know, and that's just it. These things have existed for a long time. These means have existed for a long time. Most people are not aware of such technologies. Or the fact that, I'm not going to say that they are commonly or readily available, but they are, not impossible to come by. You know, they aren't incredibly hard to track down in that kind of way. I mean, you yourself write about some of these technologies in your books, and you have to physically go to the federal government and say, hey, I'm writing a book and I'm talking about this.
Yeah.
Just well, so you're aware.
And that's why there's a third book coming out that's been delayed as long as it's been, that I was even telling my wife. I said, this, you know, I need to sit down with lawyers and figure out how to make this third book come out as I, you know, but, you know, before I'm gone. So, you know, those of us that have kind of been in this fight, you know, or, you know, one of us has already disappeared, and that was Dr. Robert Duncan.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's one of those things that I need to get out. That book will be called The Fourth Branch. It's already titled, but, I've had to go back and rewrite some things, per the request of some agencies. So people that think that there's no censorship here, you know, there is.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And consequences to be paid.
Yeah.
If you deny said censorship,
yeah.
You know, and I think that boils down a lot of things that the common person out there doesn't understand, that are, I think, misconceptions about the world of targeted individuals. And once again, the idea of giving hope to the TIs that are out there, I think that there is huge vindication for the fact that this lawsuit is pending right now, that the agencies are being held accountable for witness tampering and for literally, like, getting people to come take part in studies, almost in a way to see, like, hey, did our stuff work? It's horrifying.
Well, you know, and one other thing, I know you won't pat yourself on the back, so I'm going to pat you on the back a little bit here. But for the listeners that may be new to Curious Realm, because I know things have grown a lot with you here lately, but we started this when you were running a little show called Dudes and Beer.
Yeah,
Dudes and Beer. I mean, it was lighthearted, and it was supposed to be topics that would be interesting to a group of guys sitting around, you know, just, you know, talking some trash around a couple of beers and
yeah,
something that's interesting or something that's a phenomenon or whatever. And, you know, and especially your prior background to starting Dudes and Beer, you were with Alex Jones.
I was.
You know, you were with a big production. And I know you probably weren't necessarily looking to get back into something that was really deep or, you know, or possibly life threatening or career threatening for you. But once you had me on Dudes and Beer, and then you saw the people that were calling in and kind of yeah, approaching you for help, and because they kind of figured you knew me,
yep,
and could get some words into me or get me back on to talk about something specifically or do a live show where we would have questioning. I mean, just for the listeners, Chris came to me and he said, man, he goes, there's so many people out there being hurt by this that I really can't in good conscience continue to call this show Dudes and Beer, because it's not really, the title of the show is not giving the problem the gravity that it needs. And, and this is a true story. Chris, he's like, I'm thinking about changing this to Curious Realm because the people that I'm getting contacted with, they're really hurting and they're looking for help. And I don't want it to be coming from a show that sounds trivial or
yeah,
you know, or lighthearted like Dudes and Beer, when this is some serious stuff. I mean, Chris called me in tears after one particular person reached out for him to help. And it wasn't a month later. He's like, man, I'm starting all this over. I don't even know if you have any Dudes and Beer stuff archived anymore.
It's
that
all on
find
our YouTube channel. Every
is
single
okay
episode.
Yeah, but just for your listeners, you're the guy that helps me develop binaural beats to help some of these targeted people actually escape when they can. It is Chris that helped, and Chris changed the name of this show just because of the gravity of the situation,
yeah,
and the hurtfulness that this technology is on so many people. So.
Yeah, this is one of the many things that I consider is a cause of this show, much like Billy Joe Kane, our good friend from Radical Empathy Education Foundation, who helps with human trafficking and helps, you know, teach people empathy about human trafficking through VR, stuff like that. These are causes that once we heard about them, I couldn't turn head. I had to confront them and I had to have them on. And people would ask me all the time with Dudes and Beer why I would have it, like, dude, that's not fun. It's like, it's not about fun. It's about the conversation and the fact that there are a lot of conversations that we should be having in the world that we aren't. People just turned a blind eye or a cold shoulder or the fact of, well, that doesn't affect me. It does. It's in your backyard, not just targeted individuals, but human trafficking, all these things. They are in your backyard. They are being done in your name, people.
Well, and another couple of names I'd like to throw out there, because, I mean, I appreciate them and I know you appreciate them, and they're both good friends of ours. And I'll tell you who the only other syndicated radio show that actually took an interest enough in this to have me on and have you on repeatedly was Ground Zero with Clyde Lewis.
Yeah.
And even more importantly, man, his producer, Ron Patton.
Yeah.
When you listen to Ground Zero, you're not hearing Ron, you're hearing Clyde, or you're hearing a guest, or you're hearing somebody filling in for Clyde. But man, the guy that's producing that, that's behind the scenes, Ron Patton, he's been in this fight against mind control every bit as long as I have.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, he's no slouch on the mind control front, and he's very serious about it, you know, and has kind of his own pathways that he reaches out onto. But man, Clyde Lewis with Ground Zero and Ron Patton, two invaluable sources for this, for learning about this as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, especially when it comes to relieving yourself of this, to kind of disengaging from their technology and their system. Like we were saying, folks, it's about having that well-defined self-identity. It's about, sadly and horribly, don't rabbit hole. Don't go searching internet sites and things like that. The more you search it, the more moved by it you are, you know, and you're kind of feeding that beast in that kind of way. So get out, disengage, get with nature, leave your phone at home, things like that, you know, get to a point of finding something that makes you happy and do it regularly. That kind of thing. The shift in mentality is really key number one to starting to disengage from this stuff.
And that's true. I mean, the technology actually drags you in front of that computer every day. And yeah. I work with victims that are like, well, I spent, you know, 20 hours yesterday searching everything there is to search. Well, a lot of what you're going to find on the internet is not true.
Yep.
You know, or it's intentionally leading you down a bad pathway.
That's right.
I always tell the people that I work with that you've got to get out there and try to live your life. The more you can try to not listen to them, hold a cut. And that's the good thing, is if you hold a conversation with another human being, everybody thinks, well, they shut up then because they're listening. They're not shutting up because they're listening. The part of your brain that they're trying to entrain is occupied actually having a conversation with another individual.
Yeah.
You know, so if you get out, try to live life, try to keep a job, you know, try to ignore them as much as you can. Sometimes eventually they'll even give up on you, you know, because it's occupying their time too. Now, a lot of this is on an AI loop, or a chat box. But a lot of places, it's still a handful of people that are changing shifts and doing 12-hour shifts to harass you. You know, and once they can see that they're not going to degrade you or not get you diagnosed as schizophrenic or not have you kill somebody, you know, which, you know, that's what a lot of these controlled shooters are. They're targeting individuals, a lot of them as well.
Yeah.
They're called controlled assassins. That once they can see they're not going to control you, then they move on. You know, they're not going to expend, you know, working hours on dealing with somebody that is somewhat resistant or is making themselves resistant to the technology.
Yeah, precisely. Because if it eventually becomes a zero sum game for them, and if there's no return on, if there's no ROI, Why keep it up?
Yeah.
Sounds so horrible, but absolutely true. If there's no return on investment eventually, you know, you move on to the next target to see who and what you can do. And that's just cold, horrible fact. And it's awful to think about. But to know that there is hope, to know that there have been at least a few people that I've worked with you with, who have had fantastic results and come out the other side and they are doing great. I don't hear any reports about, incident with them anymore. They sleep well at night, you know, all kinds of things. And even the couple people that you've given me to go like scan their properties, things like that, to yeah. bring all my radio equipment out, that kind of stuff. It for me, it's more about seeing the family's response when that part of the investigation is going on, John, because it's interesting to see the way that the way that they turn around as well.
Well, and that's a recent development too, and that's kind of, I mean, you got to kind of, you know, pick and choose your little mini victories along the yeah. way. But, you know, there was a time, you know, 15 years ago when I first started in this activism, that it wasn't like that. You know, the calls I was getting from family members was more like, our son read your book and now he's crazy and yeah. thinks that, you know, satellites are after him and this is all your fault. He wouldn't think that if he hadn't read your book. Well, that's kind of gone full circle too. Now I'll have, you know, people call and they'll say, you know, I was researching what's happening to my kid and I found you and you seem to be one of the people who, you know, is talking about this in an educated fashion and knows what it is. Can I contact you and talk to you and figure out a way that I can help my wife or help my son or, you know, and I've even had police officers now call. Now, 20 years ago, if you called the police and you said, I'm hearing voices in my head and it's coming from my ceiling fan and from the vibrations in my vent fan. And they're telling me that they're going to tag me or they're going to kill my wife or, you know, you got a 5150 or you got hauled off to be examined. Now, yeah. well, that's come full circle now where I've actually had police contact me. Can you come and talk to us about this? We're dealing with this, not real frequently, but we are dealing with it. And we understand that there is technologies that can do this. But we know there's nothing that we can actually do to help these people. So, yeah. I mean, there's some small victories that have come in this. Now, the big victory, I think, that is coming with the fact that they finally kind of probably bit off more than they can chew when they targeted their own employees
yeah.
that are diplomats or CIA agents, because these people do know how the government works. And, you know, they do have people to handle them like Mark Zaid. So I think that's going to be one of the things that if we can incorporate all of the civilian targeted people into the same research and stuff that's being done with the Havana syndrome yeah. people or AHI people, then I think that we all come out and we all win. Now, the people that are still focusing on there's got to be a way I can shield myself from it. And if I buy $40,000 or the shielding material and make myself a suit that I can walk around in society with,
yeah.
that's an anechoic suit, that's not the way to go. I mean, you're never in the civilian world, you're never going to have the amount of money that was spent on this to create the technology in the first place. And even our own government really can't protect themselves from it. And, yeah. the example I give of that is, you know, if you look at where they control these drones from, the drones that are flying over Afghanistan and Iraq and, you know, Ukraine are controlled here in the United States and they're done from, you know, 5-inch thick metal containers, you yeah. know, and it's not to protect from a bomb or a missile. It's to protect from electronic harassment, you know, so the government can't protect itself from this technology either. They invented technology that they can't protect themselves or their personnel yeah. or their equipment from.
Yeah. And that's a great point to bring up, truly, is the fact of there is almost no handrail on this, you know. So the fact that there are active lawsuits out there, like we've said for so long, like we said with our good friend Robert Duncan before his passing so many times, the only way that a breakthrough happens, that a watershed moment happens, is through legal means. We've got to be able to find what it is, much like the UFO disclosure situation. It's about finding the people responsible and strangling them with the purse strings.
Yeah.
To stop the funding to the black program that this falls under, what have you. So, to hold the agency responsible for the fact that they at least baited people, A, that they admitted that people were targeted, B, that we have a diagnosis, there's an actual diagnosis out there now, and that you have suckered people in to harass them further, to garner that diagnosis from them before other people do, so that you can keep them from the help that they need, is a huge point of accountability and a huge, huge, huge point in the W column for this whole community. I think it's finally coming around to the fact of we may, and honestly, I think that we will probably have something with this before we have something on UFO UAP.
Yeah, I hope so, because you know the routine with everything else. It's always approximately 40 yeah. years later, mm-hmm. you know, whether it was the Acre hearings with radiation exposure
yeah.
or, some of the MK Ultra stuff or some of the weaponized gonorrhea or weaponized syphilis. You yeah. know, the apology, always the admission and the apology is always 40 to 60 years down the road after all of the actual victims are gone. Yeah. The apology is to the victims' families that were told that they were told that their loved one was crazy for all those years, you know. So, but hopefully that's not the case with this. It would be nice to see kind of an end to it, or at least them admit that the technology is there and start creating oversight for it while I'm still alive.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And Doctor, I can't thank you enough, A, for bringing me along in this mission, but B, for everything that you have done for literally the last 20 years on this front, and everything that you are doing now. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to follow your work, where they can go to get your books, of course, other than the Curious Realm store, all that kind of good stuff.
Yes. Amazon, Barnes & Noble's A New Breed, Satellite Terrorism, or Guinea Pigs, Technologies of Control. New book, hopefully going to come out here pretty soon, a fourth branch. Facebook is, if you need to get a hold of me, there is a Guinea Pigs Technologies of Control Facebook page. I post on it pretty much daily with, topics that kind of revolve around this or revolve around the politics that I see as being kind of working toward the end of it. And certainly yeah. through Curious Realm.
Absolutely. Hold the line real quick, Doctor. It's always a pleasure having you on. Always a pleasure talking before and after the show. Hold the line while we close things out for this segment. All right.
Thank you, Chris.
Absolutely. Thank you. While you are online getting your copy of Guinea Pigs Technologies of Control, as well as A New Breed, Satellite Terrorism in America, stop on by Bandcamp. If you are a targeted individual, the first album in my Music for Targeted Minds series was made for targeted individuals. So, of course, we can craft custom beats for people, custom binaural beats to target your specific symptomologies, your specific issues. But this is always where I send people first, is to this album. If you know somebody that's targeted, if you are targeted, stop on by, check that out. I've heard great results from it, from targeted people. Most people I don't even have to get together with to make custom beats. They tell me that this does the job. So you can get that. You can find the links to that, to all of Dr. John Hall's books, right there at curiousrealm.com/store, folks, as well as curiousresearch.org/store. Thank you so much, everybody, for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation possible. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So going into this new year, remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.